figuring out what someone else needs or should do, we are not in touch with our own feelings and are unable to make wise decisions about important aspects of our lives that trouble us. We often do not really know who we are, and being embroiled in dramatic problems keeps us from having to hold still and find out. None of this is to say that we may not emote. We may cry and scream and weep and wail, but we are not able to use our emotions to guide us in making the necessary and important choices in our life. You may have a tendency toward episodes of depression, which you try to forestall through the excitement provided by an unstable relationship. An example. One of my clients, who had a history of depression and was married to an alcoholic, likened living with him to having a car accident every day. The terrific ups and downs, the surprises, the maneuvers, the unpredictability and instability of the relationship cumulatively presented a constant and daily shock to her system. If you've ever had a car accident in which you weren't seriously injured, you may have experienced a definite up feeling the day or so following the event. This is because your body had undergone an extreme shock, and adrenaline was suddenly available in unusually high amounts. This adrenaline accounts for the high. If you are someone who struggles with depression, you will unconsciously seek situations that keep you stirred up, much like the car accident or the marriage to an alcoholic, so that you stay too high to feel low. Depression, alcoholism, and eating disorders are closely related and seem to be genetically linked. Most anorexics with whom I have worked, for instance, had two alcoholic parents, and many of my women clients with problems of depression had at least one alcoholic parent. If you are someone who came from an alcoholic family, you are likely on two counts to have problems with depression, because of your past and because of your genetic inheritances. Ironically, the excitement of a relationship with someone with that disease may strongly appeal to you. You are not attracted to men who are kind, stable, reliable, and interested in you. You find such nice men boring. We find the unstable man exciting, the unreliable man challenging, the unpredictable man romantic, the immature man charming, the moody man mysterious. The angry man needs our understanding. The unhappy man needs our comforting. The inadequate man needs our encouragement. And the cold man needs our warmth. But we cannot fix a man who is fine just as he is. And if he is kind and cares for us, then we can't suffer either. Unfortunately, if we can't love a man too much, we usually can't love him at all. In the chapters that follow, each of the women you will meet has, like Jill, a story to tell about loving too much. Through their stories, perhaps you will be helped to understand the patterns of your own life more clearly. Then you will also be able to employ the tools given toward the end of the book to change those patterns into a new configuration of self-fulfillment, love, and joy. This is my wish for you. Chapter 2. Good Sex in Bad Relationships. The young woman who sat in front of me was wrapped in despair. Her pretty face still displayed yellow and green traces of the terrible bruises she had received a month ago when she had deliberately driven her car off a cliff. "It was in the newspaper," she told me slowly, painfully, "all about the accident, with pictures of the car dangling there. But he never even got in touch with me." Her voice raised a little, and just a hint of healthy anger flickered before she slid back into her desolation. Trudy, who had very nearly died for love, then brought up what was for her the central question, the one that made the abandonment by her lover inexplicable and nearly unendurable. "How could the sex between us be so good, make us both feel so wonderful and bring us so close together, when we really had nothing else going for us? Why did that work when nothing else did?" As she began to cry, she gave every appearance of a very young, very hurt child. I thought I was making him love me by giving myself to him. I gave him everything, everything I had to give. She leaned over, holding her stomach and rocking. Oh, but it hurts to know that I could do all that for nothing. Trudy remained doubled up, sobbing for a long time, lost in the empty place where her myth of love had lived. When she was able to talk again, she continued in the same muted wail. All I ever cared about was making Jim happy and keeping him with me. I didn't ask for anything except that he spend time with me. After Trudy had cried again for a while, I remembered what she had told me about her family and asked her softly, "Wasn't that what your mother wanted from your father, too? Basically, just that he spend time with her." Suddenly, she sat upright. "Oh, my God. You're right. I even sound just like my mother. The person I most wanted not to be like, the one who ran around making suicide attempts to get her way. Oh, my God," she repeated, and then looked at me, face wet with tears, and said quietly, "That's really awful." She paused, and I spoke. "Lots of times, we find ourselves doing the things our same-sex parent did, the very actions we promised ourselves we would never, never do. It's because we learned from their actions, even their feelings, what it is to be a man or a woman." "But I didn't try to kill myself to get back at Jim," Trudy protested. "I just couldn't stand how awful I felt, how worthless and unwanted." Another pause. "Maybe that's the way my mother felt, too. I guess that's the way you end up feeling when you try to keep someone around who has other, more important things to do." Trudy had tried, all right, and the enticement she had used was sex. In a later session, when the pain wasn't quite so fresh, the subject of sex came up again. "I've always been very sexually responsive," she reported, with a mixture of pride and guilt. "So much so that in high school I was afraid I was a nymphomaniac. All I could think about was the next time my boyfriend and I could be together to make love. I was always trying to arrange everything so that we could have some place to go and be alone together. They say that guys are supposed to be the ones who always want sex. I know I wanted it more than he did. At least, I went to a lot more trouble to make it happen than he did." Trudy was 16 when she and her high school steady first went all the way, as she put it. He was a football player who took the fact that he was in training very seriously. He seemed to believe that too much sex with Trudy was going to diminish his prowess on the playing field. While he made excuses about not staying out too late before a game, she countered by arranging for afternoon babysitting sessions, during which she could seduce him on the front room couch while the infant slept in the nearby nursery. Eventually, though, Trudy's most creative efforts to transmute his passion for sports into a passion for her failed, and this young man, courtesy of a football scholarship, left for a distant college. After a spell of crying nightly and berating herself for not having been able to persuade him to choose her over his athletic ambitions, Trudy was ready to try again. It was the summer between high school and college, and she was still living at home, a home that was coming apart at the seams. After years of threatening to do so, Trudy's mother had finally initiated divorce proceedings, hiring an attorney known for his willingness to fight dirty. Her parents' marriage had been of the stormiest order, pitting her father's compulsive workaholism against her mother's fervent, sometimes violent, and occasionally self-destructive efforts at coercing him to spend more time with her and their two children, Trudy and her older sister, Beth. He was so rarely home, and for such brief periods, that his wife caustically referred to these sojourns as pit stops. "They were the pits, all right," Trudy remembered. "His visits always degenerated into horrible, protracted fights, with mother screaming and accusing him of not loving any of us, and father insisting that he worked as hard and as long as he did for our sakes. The times he did spend at home always seemed to end with the two of them screaming at each other. He'd usually leave, slamming the door and yelling, "No wonder I never want to come home." But sometimes, if Mother had sobbed enough or had threatened him again with divorce or maybe taken a lot of pills and gone to the hospital, he would change for a while, come home early, and spend time with us. Mother would start making these wonderful meals to reward him, I guess, for coming home to his family. She frowned. After about 3 or 4 nights, he'd be late again, and there'd be a phone call. "Oh, I see. Oh, really?" Mother would say, all icy. Pretty soon, she'd start screaming obscenities at him, and then bang the phone down. Now here we were, Beth and I, all dressed up because Daddy was supposed to come home for dinner. We probably had set the table especially nicely, the way Mother always told us to when he was supposed to come home, with candles and flowers. And here Mother would be, storming around the kitchen, screaming and banging pots and calling Daddy horrible names. Then she'd calm down, go all icy again, and come out to tell us that we would just eat alone, without him. That was even worse than the screaming. She'd serve us and sit down, never looking at us. We'd get so nervous, Beth and I, with all the quiet. We wouldn't dare speak, and we wouldn't dare not eat. We'd stay there at the table, trying to make it better for Mother. But there was really nothing we could do for her. After those meals, I usually got sick in the middle of the night with terrible nausea and vomiting. Trudy shook her head stoically. Definitely not conducive to healthy digestion. Or to learning healthy patterns of relating, I added. For it was in this climate that Trudy learned what little she knew about dealing with someone she loved. "What was it like for you when that was going on?" I asked her. Trudy thought for a while, and then nodded as she responded, emphasizing the correctness of her answer. "In the middle of it, I was scared, but mostly I felt lonely. No one was looking my way or wondering what I was feeling or doing. My sister was so shy, we never talked much. She hid out in her room when she wasn't taking music lessons. She played her flute, mostly, I think, to shut out the arguments and to give herself an excuse to stay out of everybody's way. I learned not to make trouble either. I kept quiet, pretended I didn't notice what my parents were doing to each other, and in fact, kept everything I was thinking to myself. I tried to do well in school. Sometimes it felt like that was the only time my father ever noticed me. 'Let me see your report card,' he'd say, and we'd talk about it together for a little while. He admired any kind of achievement, so I tried to do well for him." Trudy rubbed her brow and continued thoughtfully. "There's another feeling, too. Sad. I think I felt sad all the time, but I never told anyone. If someone had asked, 'What do you feel inside?' I would have said I was fine, absolutely fine. Even if I could have said I was sad, I could never have explained why. How could I justify feeling that way? I wasn't suffering. Nothing important was missing from my life. I mean, we never missed a meal, never went without anything we needed." Trudy was still unable to fully acknowledge the depth of her emotional isolation in that family. She had suffered from a dearth of nurturing and attention because of a father who was virtually inaccessible and a mother who was consumed by her anger and frustration with him. This had left Trudy and her sister starved emotionally. Ideally, as she grew up, Trudy would have been able to practice sharing who she was with her parents in return for their love and attention. But her parents were unable to be on the receiving end of this gift of herself. They were too caught up in their battle of wills. So as she grew older, she took herself and her gift of love, in the guise of sex, elsewhere. But she offered herself to equally unwilling or unavailable recipients. What else, after all, did she know how to do? Nothing else would have felt right or would have fit with the lack of love and attention to which she was already accustomed. Meanwhile, the conflict between her parents heated up in the new arena of the divorce court. In the midst of the fireworks, Trudy's sister ran off with her music teacher. Her parents scarcely paused in their battle long enough to register the fact that their elder daughter had left the state with a man twice her age who was barely able to support himself. Trudy, too, was looking for love, dating men frenetically and going to bed with nearly every one of them. In her heart, she believed that the problems at home were her mother's fault, that her mother had driven her father away with nagging and threats. Trudy vowed she would never, ever be the kind of angry, demanding woman she saw her mother to be. She would instead win her man with love, understanding, and the total gift of herself. She tried once already with the football player to be so devotedly loving and giving as to be irresistible, but her approach hadn't worked. She concluded not that her approach was mistaken or that the object of her approach was a poor choice, but that she hadn't given enough. So she kept trying, kept giving, yet none of the young men she dated stayed around. The fall semester began, and Trudy soon met a married man, Jim, in one of her classes at the local city college. He was a policeman studying law enforcement theory there to make himself eligible for promotion. He was 30, had 2 children, and a pregnant wife. Over coffee one afternoon, he told Trudy how young he'd been when he married and how little happiness he felt in his relationship with his wife. He warned her, in a fatherly fashion, not to get caught in the same domestic trap by getting married early and being tied down to responsibilities. Trudy felt flattered that he would confide in her about something so private as his disenchantment with married life. He seemed kind and vulnerable somehow, a little lonely and misunderstood. Jim told her how much talking to her had meant to him, indeed, how he'd never talked to anyone quite like her before, and asked if she'd meet him again. Trudy quickly agreed, for although theirs had been a fairly one-sided conversation that day, with Jim doing most of the talking, it was still more communication than Trudy had ever experienced within her family. Their chat provided her with a taste of the attention she craved. 2 days later, they talked again, this time walking in the hills above the campus, and he kissed her at the end of their stroll. Within a week, they were trysting at the apartment of an on-duty policeman 3 afternoons of the 5 that Trudy spent at school, and her life began to revolve around their stolen time together. Trudy refused to look at how her involvement with Jim was affecting her. She skipped classes and began, for the first time, to fail scholastically. She lied to friends about her activities and then avoided them completely so that she didn't have to keep on lying. She curtailed nearly every social activity, caring only about being with Jim when she could, thinking about him when she couldn't. She wanted to be available to him in case there was an extra hour here or there that they could spend together. In return, Jim gave her a great deal of attention and flattery when they were together. He managed to say exactly what she needed to hear, about how wonderful, how special, how lovable she was, how she made him happier than he'd ever been before. His words stirred her to try even harder to thrill and delight him. First, she bought beautiful lingerie to wear just for him, then perfume and oils, which he cautioned her against using because his wife might notice their scent and wonder what was going on. Undaunted, she read books on lovemaking and tried everything she learned on him. His rapture spurred her on. There was no greater aphrodisiac for her than being able to arouse this man. She responded powerfully to his attraction to her. It wasn't her sexuality she was expressing, as much as her feelings of being validated by his sexual responsiveness to her. Because she was actually much more in touch with his sexuality than with her own. The more responsive he was, the more gratified she felt. She interpreted the time he stole from his other life to be with her as the validation of her worth for which she hungered. When she wasn't with him, she thought about new ways to enchant him. Her friends finally quit asking her to join them, and her life narrowed to a single pointed obsession, making Jim happier than he'd ever been. She felt a thrill of victory in their every encounter, victory over his disenchantment with life, his inability to experience love and sexual fulfillment. That she could make him happy made her happy. Finally, her love was working its magic in someone's life. It was what she'd always wanted. She wasn't like her mother, driving someone away with her demands. Instead, she was creating a bond built entirely of love and selflessness. She prided herself on how little she asked of Jim. I was very lonely when I wasn't with him, which was a lot of the time. I saw him for only 2 hours, 3 days a week, and he never contacted me in between. He took classes on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and we'd meet afterward. The time we had together was mostly spent making love. When we were finally alone, we would just rush at each other. It was so intense, so exciting, that sometimes it was hard for either of us to believe that sex could be that thrilling for any other people in the world. And then, of course, afterward, we always had to say goodbye. All the other hours in the week when I wasn't with him were empty. I spent most of the time we were apart getting ready to see him again. I'd wash my hair with a special shampoo, do my nails, and just drift along, thinking about him. I wouldn't let myself think too much about his wife and family. I believed that he'd been trapped into a marriage before he was old enough to really know what he wanted, and the fact that he had no intention of leaving, no intention of running away from his obligations, endeared him to me all the more, and made me all the more comfortable with him, Trudy might well have added. She was not capable of a sustained, intimate relationship, so the buffer that Jim's marriage and family provided was actually welcome, just as the football player's reluctance to be with her had been. We are only comfortable relating in ways that are already familiar, and Jim provided both the distance and the lack of commitment that Trudy already knew so well from her parents' relationship to her. The second semester of school was nearly over. Summer was coming, and Trudy asked Jim what would happen to them when school was out, and they no longer had that convenient excuse for meeting. He began to frown and answered vaguely.
I'm not sure. I'll figure something out.
The frown was enough to stop her. All that tied the two of them together was the happiness she was able to give him. If he wasn't happy, it might all come to an end. She mustn't make him frown. School ended, and Jim hadn't figured it out.
I'll call you, he said.
She waited. A friend's father offered her a job in his resort hotel for the summer. Several of her friends also had jobs there and urged her to join them. It would be fun, they promised her, working at the lake all summer. She turned down the offer, afraid she'd miss Jim's call. Though she rarely left the house for 3 weeks, the call never came. One hot afternoon in mid-July, Trudy was downtown, listlessly shopping. She came out of an air-conditioned store, blinking in the bright sunlight. And there was Jim, tanned, smiling, and holding hands with a woman who could only be his wife. With them were two young children, a boy and a girl, and on Jim's chest, in a blue sling, an infant. Trudy's eyes sought Jim's. He stared back briefly, then looked away, walking past her with his family, his wife, his life. Somehow she made it to her car, even though the pain in her chest nearly prevented her from breathing. She sat there, in the hot parking lot, sobbing and gasping for air, until long after the sun went down. Then slowly, dimly, she drove to the college and up into the hills behind it, the hills where she and Jim had first strolled, first kissed. She drove until the road dropped steeply on one side, and then went straight where she should have turned. That she survived the crash more or less intact was miraculous. It was also a great disappointment to her. Lying in the hospital bed, she vowed to try again, as soon as they let her out. She got through the transfer to the psych ward, the numbing drugs, the obligatory interview with the psychiatrist. Her parents came to see her in separate shifts, worked out elaborately through the nursing station. Her father's appearances produced stern lectures about how much she had to live for, during which Trudy silently counted the number of times he glanced at his watch. He usually ended with a helpless,
Now you know your mother and I each love you, honey. Promise me you won't do this again.
Trudy promised dutifully, forcing a small smile, cold with the loneliness of lying to her father about something so important. His visits were followed by her mother's, who paced around the room, demanding insistently, "How could you do this to yourself? How could you do this to us? Why didn't you tell me something was wrong? What on earth is the matter, anyway? Are you upset about your father and me?" Then her mother would settle down into one of the chairs provided for visitors and offer a detailed description of how the divorce was proceeding, which was supposed to be reassuring. Trudy was usually sick to her stomach during the night after these visits. On her last night in the hospital, a nurse sat quietly with her and asked her some gently probing questions. The whole story came pouring out. The nurse finally said to her, "I know you're thinking of trying it again. Why shouldn't you? Nothing's different tonight than it was a week ago. But before you do, I want you to see someone." The nurse, a former client of mine, referred her to me. So Trudy and I began our work together, the work of healing her need to give more love than she received, to give and give from an already empty place inside her. There were a few more men in her life over the next 2 years who enabled her to examine how she used sex in her relationships. One was a professor at the university where she was now enrolled. He was a workaholic of her father's caliber, and at first Trudy threw herself into an intense effort to coax him away from his work and into her loving arms. This time, though, she felt keenly the frustration of her struggle to change him and gave it up after 5 months. At first, the challenge had been stimulating, and each time she won his attention for the evening, she had felt validated. But Trudy felt herself becoming more and more dependent on him emotionally, while he, in return, gave less and less. During one session, she reported, "Last night I was with David, and I was crying, telling him how important he was to me. He started to give me his usual answer about how I just have to understand that he had these important commitments to his work. Well, I just stopped listening. I'd heard it all before, anyway. It suddenly became very clear to me that I'd played this scene before, with my football-playing boyfriend. I was throwing myself at David the same way I had with him." She smiled ruefully. "You have no idea the lengths to which I've gone in order to win men's attention. I've run around throwing off my clothes and blowing in their ears and trying every seductive trick I know. I'm still trying to get attention from someone who isn't very interested in me. I think the biggest thrill I feel with David when we do make love is that I've been able to arouse him enough to distract him from what he'd rather be doing. I hate admitting this, but that has been a big turn-on for me, just being able to get David or Jim or anyone to pay attention to me. I guess because basically I have felt so bad about each relationship, the sex has brought a lot of relief. It seems for a few moments to dissolve all the barriers and bring us together. And I've wanted that togetherness so much. But I'm really not willing to keep throwing myself at David. It feels too degrading." Still, David was not the last of Trudy's impossible men, by any means. Her next beau was a young stockbroker who was a dedicated triathlon competitor. She competed as hard as he did, but for his attention, trying to lure him away from his rigorous training schedule with the constant promise of her willing body. Much of the time when they did make love, he was either too tired or too uninterested to achieve or maintain an erection. One day, in my office, she was describing their most recent failed attempt at lovemaking, and suddenly she began to laugh. "When I think about it, it's too much. No one has ever worked harder than I have to make love to someone who would rather not." More laughter. Then finally, firmly, "I've got to stop doing this. I'm going to quit looking. I seem to always be attracted to the men who have nothing to offer me and don't even want what I have to offer them." This was an important turning point for Trudy. She had become more able to love herself through the process of therapy, and now she could evaluate a relationship as unrewarding instead of concluding that she was unlovable and should try harder. The strong drive to use her sexuality to establish a relationship with a reluctant or impossible partner diminished sharply, and by the time she left therapy after 2 years, she was casually dating several young men and sleeping with none of them. It's so different to be on a date with someone and to actually be paying attention to whether I like him, whether I'm having a good time, whether I think he's a nice person. I never thought these things before. I was always trying so hard to make whoever I was with like me, to make sure he had a good time with me and thought I was nice, you know. After a date, I never thought about whether I wanted to see the person again. I was too busy wondering if he liked me enough to call me for another date. I had it all backward. When Trudy decided to leave therapy, she no longer had it backward. She could spot an impossible relationship easily, and even if a spark of attraction between her and a reluctant suitor flared, it died quickly in her cool assessment of the man, the situation, and the possibilities. She was no longer in the market for pain and rejection. She wanted someone who could really be a partner to her, or no one at all. Nothing in between would do. But the fact remained that Trudy knew nothing about living with the opposites of pain and rejection, comfort and commitment. She had never known the degree of intimacy that comes from being in the kind of relationship she now required. Though she had yearned for closeness with a partner, she had never had to function in a climate of true closeness. That she had been drawn to rejecting men was no accident. Trudy's tolerance for being truly intimate was low. There had been no intimacy in her family as she grew up, only battles and treaties, each treaty more or less marking the beginning of the next battle. There had been pain and tension, and occasionally some relief from pain and tension, but never real sharing, real closeness, or real love. In reaction to her mother's manipulations, Trudy's formula for loving had been to give of herself without asking anything in return. When therapy helped her out of the trap of her self-sacrificing martyrdom, she was left knowing clearly what not to do, which was a great improvement, but she was only halfway home. Trudy's next task was to learn to simply be in the company of men whom she considered nice, even if she also found them a little boring. Boredom is the sensation that women who love too much so often experience when they find themselves with a nice man. No bells peal, no rockets explode, no stars fall from heaven. In the absence of excitement, they feel antsy, irritable, and awkward, a generally uncomfortable state that is covered over with the label boredom. Trudy didn't know how to behave in the presence of a man who was kind, considerate, and really interested in her. Like all women who love too much, her skills at relating were honed for a challenge, not for simply enjoying a man's company. If she didn't have to maneuver and manipulate in order to keep a relationship going, she found it difficult to relate to the man, to feel comfortable and at ease. Because she was used to excitement and pain, struggle and victory or defeat, an interchange that lacked these powerful components felt too tame to be important, and unsettling as well. Ironically, there would be more discomfort in the presence of steady, dependable, cheerful, stable fellows than there ever had been with men who were unresponsive, emotionally distant, unavailable, or uninterested. A woman who loves too much is used to negative traits and behaviors, and she will be more comfortable with them than with their opposites unless and until she works very hard to change that fact for herself. Unless Trudy could learn to relate comfortably to a man who considered her best interests as important as his own, she had no hope of ever achieving a rewarding relationship. Before recovery, a woman who loves too much usually exhibits the following characteristics regarding how she feels and how she relates to men sexually. She asks the question, "How much does he love or need me?" and not, "How much do I care for him?" Most of her sexual interactions with him are motivated by, "How can I get him to love or need me more?"
Her drive to give herself sexually to others whom she perceives as needy may result in behavior that she herself labels promiscuous, but her behavior is primarily for another's gratification rather than for her own. Sex is one of the tools she uses for manipulating or changing her partner. She often finds the power struggles of mutual manipulation very exciting. She behaves seductively to get her own way and feels great when it works and bad when it doesn't. Failing to get what she wants usually causes her to try even harder. She confuses anxiety, fear, and pain with love and sexual excitement. She calls the sensation of having a knot in her stomach love. She takes her excitement from his excitement. She doesn't know how to feel good for herself. In fact, she is threatened by her own feelings. Unless the challenge of an unfulfilling relationship is there, she becomes restless. She is not sexually attracted to a man with whom she is not struggling. Instead, she labels him boring. She often teams up with a man who is less experienced sexually in order that she feel in control. She yearns for physical closeness, but because she fears being enveloped by another and/or being overwhelmed by her own needs for nurturing, she is only comfortable with the emotional distance created and maintained by stress in the relationship. She becomes fearful when a man is willing to be there for her emotionally as well as sexually. She either runs away or drives him away. Trudy's poignant question at the beginning of our work together, how could the sex between us be so good, make us both feel so wonderful and bring us so close together when we really had nothing else going for us, is one that merits examining, because women who love too much often face the dilemma of good sex in an unhappy or hopeless relationship. Many of us have been taught that good sex means real love, and that, conversely, sex couldn't be really satisfying and fulfilling if the relationship as a whole were not right for us. Nothing could be further from the truth for women who love too much. Because of the dynamics operating at every level of our interactions with men, including the sexual level, a bad relationship may actually contribute to sex being exciting, passionate, and compelling. We may be hard-pressed to explain to family and friends how someone who is not particularly admirable or even very likable can nevertheless arouse in us a thrill of anticipation and an intensity of longing never matched by what we feel for someone nicer or more presentable. It is difficult to articulate that we are enchanted by the dream of calling forth all the positive attributes, the love, caring, attention, integrity, and nobility. We are sure are lying dormant in our lover, waiting to blossom in the warmth of our love. Women who love too much often tell themselves that the man with whom they are involved has never really been loved before, not by his parents, nor by his previous wives or girlfriends. We see him as damaged and readily take on the task of making up for all that was missing in his life long before we ever met him. In a way, the scenario is a sexually role-reversed version of the tale of Snow White, who slept under a spell, waiting for the liberation that comes with her true love's first kiss. We want to be the one to break the spell, to free this man from what we see as his imprisonment. We take his emotional unavailability, his anger or depression or cruelty or indifference or violence or dishonesty or addiction, for signs that he has not been loved enough. We pit our love against his faults, his failings, even his pathology. We are determined to save him through the power of our love. Sex is one of the primary ways we try to love him toward health. Every sexual encounter carries all our striving to change him. With every kiss and every touch, we work at communicating to him how special and worthy he is, how much he is admired and cherished. We feel sure that once he is convinced of our love, he will be metamorphosed into his true self, awakened to the embodiment of everything we want and need him to be. In a way, sex under such circumstances is good because we need it to be. We put a great deal of energy into making it work, making it wonderful.
Whatever response we elicit encourages us to try harder, to be more loving, to be more convincing. And there are other factors operating as well. For instance, though it would seem that fulfilling sex would not be very likely in an unhappy relationship, it is important to remember that a sexual climax is a discharge of both physical and emotional tension. While one woman may avoid sexual involvement with her partner when there is conflict and strain between them, another woman in similar circumstances may find sex to be a highly effective way of releasing much of that tension, at least temporarily. For a woman in an unhappy relationship or with a partner to whom she is ill-matched, the sex act may be the one aspect of the relationship that is gratifying and the one way of relating to him that works. In fact, the degree of sexual release she experiences may be directly related to the degree of discomfort she feels with her partner. This is easy to understand. Many couples, whether their relationship is healthy or otherwise, experience particularly good sex after a fight. Following a conflict, two elements contribute to especially intense and rapturous lovemaking. One is the aforementioned release of tension. The other involves a tremendous investment, after a fight, in making sex work in order to cement the couple's bond that has been threatened by their quarrel. The fact that the couple enjoys a particularly pleasurable and satisfying sexual experience under these circumstances can seem to validate the relationship as a whole. Look at how close we are, how loving we can be with each other, how good we can make each other feel. We really do belong together, may be the sentiment generated. The sex act, when it is highly gratifying physically, has the power to create deeply felt bonds between two people. For women who love too much, especially, the intensity of our struggle with a man may contribute to the intensity of our sexual experience with him, and thus our bond to him. And the converse is also true. When we are involved with a man who is not so much of a challenge, the sexual dimension may also lack fire and passion, because we are not in an almost constant state of excitement over him, and because sex isn't used to prove something, we may find an easier, more relaxed relationship to be somewhat tame. Compared to the tempestuous styles of relating that we've known, this tamer kind of experience only seems to verify for us that tension, struggle, heartache, and drama truly do equal real love. Which brings us to a discussion of what real love is. Though love seems to be very difficult to define, I submit that this is because we try in this culture to combine two very opposite and even apparently mutually exclusive aspects of love in one definition. Thus, the more we say about love, the more we contradict ourselves. And when we find one aspect of love battling another, we give up in confusion and frustration and decide that love is too personal, too mysterious, and too enigmatic to pin down precisely. The Greeks were smarter. They used different words, eros and agape, to distinguish between these two profoundly different ways of experiencing what we call love. Eros, of course, refers to passionate love, while agape describes the stable and committed relationship, free of passion, that exists between two individuals who care deeply for each other. The contrast of eros and agape allows us to understand our dilemma when we look for both these kinds of love at one time, in one relationship, with one person. It also helps us see why eros and agape each have their champions, those who claim that one or the other is the only real way of experiencing love, for indeed each has its very special beauty, truth, and worth. And each type of love also lacks something precious, which only the other has to offer. Let's look at how proponents of each would describe being in love. Eros. Real love is an all-consuming, desperate yearning for the beloved, who is perceived as different, mysterious, and elusive. The depth of love is measured by the intensity of obsession with the loved one. There is little time or attention for other interests or pursuits, because so much energy is focused on recalling past encounters or imagining future ones. Often great obstacles must be overcome, and thus there is an element of suffering in true love. Another indication of the depth of love is the willingness to endure pain and hardship for the sake of the relationship. Associated with real love are feelings of excitement, rapture, drama, anxiety, tension, mystery, and yearning. Agape. Real love is a partnership to which two caring people are deeply committed. These people share many basic values, interests, and goals, and tolerate good-naturedly their individual differences. The depth of love is measured by the mutual trust and respect they feel toward each other. Their relationship allows each to be more fully expressive, creative, and productive in the world. There is much joy in shared experiences, both past and present, as well as those that are anticipated. Each views the other as his or her dearest and most cherished friend. Another measure of the depth of love is the willingness to look honestly at oneself in order to promote the growth of the relationship and the deepening of intimacy. Associated with real love are feelings of serenity, security, devotion, understanding, companionship, mutual support, and comfort. Passionate love, eros, is what the woman who loves too much usually feels for the man who is impossible. Indeed, it is because he is impossible that there is so much passion. In order for passion to exist, there needs to be a continuing struggle, obstacles to overcome, a yearning for more than is available. Passion literally means suffering, and it is often the case that the greater the suffering, the deeper the passion. The thrilling intensity of a passionate love affair cannot be matched by the gentler comforts of a stable, committed relationship, so were she to finally receive from the object of her passion what she has so ardently desired, the suffering would stop, and the passion would soon burn itself out. Then, perhaps, she would tell herself she had fallen out of love, because the bittersweet pain would be gone. The society in which we live and the ever-present media that surround and saturate our consciousness confuse the two kinds of love constantly. We are promised in thousands of ways that a passionate relationship, eros, will bring us contentment and fulfillment, agape. In fact, the implication is that, with great enough passion, a lasting bond will be forged. All the failed relationships based initially on tremendous passion can testify that this premise is false. Frustration, suffering, and yearning do not contribute to a stable, sustained, nurturing relationship, though they certainly are factors that contribute mightily to a passionate one. Common interests, common values and goals, and a capacity for deep, sustained intimacy are required if a couple's initial erotic enchantment with each other is to eventually metamorphose into a committed, caring devotion that will endure over time. However, what often happens is this. In a passionate relationship, fraught as it must be with the excitement, suffering, and frustration of new love, there is the feeling that something very important is missing. What is wanted is commitment, a means of stabilizing this chaotic emotional experience and providing a feeling of safety and security. Should the obstacles to their being together be overcome and a genuine commitment forged, these two partners may eventually look at each other and wonder where the passion has gone. They feel safe and warm and kindly toward each other, but a little cheated too, because they are no longer fired with desire for each other. The price we pay for passion is fear, and the very pain and fear that feed passionate love may also destroy it. The price we pay for stable commitment is boredom, and the very safety and security that cement such a relationship can also make it rigid and lifeless. If there is to be continued excitement and challenge in the relationship after commitment, it must be based not on frustration or longing, but on an ever deeper exploration of what D.H. Lawrence calls the joyful mysteries between a man and a woman who are committed to each other. As Lawrence implies, this is perhaps best done with one partner, for the trust and the honesty of agape must combine with the courage and vulnerability of passion in order to create true intimacy.
I once heard a recovering alcoholic put it so simply and so beautifully. He said, "When I was drinking, I went to bed with lots of women, and basically, I had the same experience many times. Since I've been sober, I've only been to bed with my wife, but each time we're together, it's a new experience." The thrill and excitement that comes not from arousing and being aroused, but from knowing and being known, is all too rare. Most of us in committed, stable relationships settle for predictability, comfort, and companionship because we fear exploring the mysteries that we embody together as man and woman, the exposure of our deepest selves. Yet in our fear of the unknown within us and between us, we ignore and avoid the very gift that our commitment sets within our reach, true intimacy. For women who love too much, developing true intimacy with a partner can come only after recovery. Later in the book, we'll meet Trudy again as she faces this challenge of recovery that awaits us all. Chapter 3. If I suffer for you, will you love me? It was necessary for me to lean across several stacked canvases in order to read the framed verse that hung in the middle of the cluttered apartment's living room wall. Time-worn and faded, the old-fashioned landscape with its printed poem read, "My dear mother, mother, dear mother, when I think of you, I want to be all that is fine, that is true, all that is worthy, noble, or grand, has come from you, mother, from your guiding hand." Lisa, an artist of very modest income, whose living quarters doubled as her art studio, waved at the poem and laughed lightly. "It's too much, isn't it? So corny." But her next words betrayed a deeper sentiment. "I saved it when a friend of mine was moving and going to throw it out. She'd gotten it from a thrift store as a joke. I think there's some truth to it, though, don't you?" Then she laughed again and said ruefully, "Loving my mother has got me into a lot of trouble with men." At this, Lisa paused and reflected. Tall, with wide-set green eyes and long, straight, dark hair, she was a beauty. She motioned me to sit on a quilt-covered mattress in a relatively uncrowded corner of the floor and offered me tea. As it brewed, she remained silent for a few moments. Lisa had come to my attention through a mutual friend who had told me some of her history. Because she had grown up with alcoholism in her family, Lisa was a codependent. The word codependent simply refers to someone who has developed an unhealthy pattern of relating to others as a result of having been closely involved with someone with the disease of alcoholism. Whether the alcoholic has been a parent, spouse, child, or friend, their relationship usually causes certain feelings and behavior to develop in the codependent. Low self-esteem, a need to be needed, a strong urge to change and control others, and a willingness to suffer. In fact, all the characteristics of women who love too much are usually present in the daughters and wives of alcoholics and other addicts. I already knew that the effects of a childhood spent trying to take care of and protect her alcoholic mother had profoundly influenced how Lisa related to men later in life. I waited patiently, and soon she began to offer some details. She was the middle of three children, between an older sister who was the reason for her parents' hasty marriage, and a younger brother who was another surprise, born 8 years after Lisa, while her mother was still drinking. Lisa was the product of their only planned pregnancy. "I always thought my mother was perfect, maybe because I needed so badly for her to be. I made her into the mother I wanted and then told myself that I would be just like her. What a fantasy I lived in." Lisa shook her head and continued, "I was born when she and my father were most in love, so I was her favorite. Even though she said she loved us all the same, I knew that I was very special to her. We always spent as much time together as we could. When I was very young, I guess she did take care of me, but after a while, we changed roles and I started taking care of her. My father was horrible most of the time. He treated her rudely and gambled all our money away. He made a good salary as an engineer, but we never had anything, and we were always moving. You know, that little poem describes the way I wanted it to be much more than the way it really was. I'm finally beginning to see that. All my life, I wanted my mother to be the person that poem describes, but most of the time, she wasn't able to even come close to being my ideal mother because she was drunk. Very early, I began pouring all my love and devotion and energy into her, hoping to get back what I needed from her, to get back what I was giving. Lisa paused, and her eyes clouded for a moment. I'm learning all this in therapy, and sometimes it hurts a lot to look at how it really was instead of how I always thought I could make it be. My mother and I were so close, but very early, so early, I can't remember when it happened. I began to act like I was the mother and she was the child. I worried about her and tried to protect her from my father. I did little things to cheer her up. I tried hard to make her happy because she was all I had. I knew she cared for me because often she would tell me to come sit by her and we'd stay that way for a long time, snuggled up together and not really talking, just holding on to each other. Now, when I look back, I realize I was always afraid for her, always waiting for something awful to happen, something that I should have been able to prevent if only I'd been careful enough. That's a tough way to live when you're growing up, but I never knew anything else, and it took its toll. By the time I was a teenager, I was having serious episodes of depression. Lisa laughed softly. What scared me most about the depression was that I couldn't take very good care of my mother when I was in the middle of it. You see, I was very conscientious and so afraid of letting go of her, even for a little while. The only way I could let go of her was by grabbing onto someone else. She brought the tea on a red and black lacquered tray and placed it on the floor before us. When I was 19, I had the opportunity to go to Mexico with two girlfriends. It was absolutely the first time I had ever left my mother. We were to stay 3 weeks, and the second week I was there, I met this terrifically handsome Mexican man who spoke beautiful English and was very gallant and attentive to me. By the third week of my vacation, he was asking me daily to marry him. He said he was in love with me and couldn't bear the thought of being without me now that he'd found me. Well, that was probably the perfect argument to use with me. I mean, he was saying he needed me, and everything in me responded to being needed. Besides, I think I knew at some level that I had to get away from my mother. It was so dark and dreary and grim at home. And this man was promising me a wonderful life. His family was wealthy. He had a fine education. He didn't do anything that I could see, but I thought that was because they had so much money he didn't have to work. That he had all that money available to him and still thought he needed me to make him happy made me feel terribly important and worthwhile. I called my mother and described him in glowing terms to her. She said, "I trust you to make the right decision." Well, she shouldn't have. I decided to marry him, which was definitely a mistake. You see, I had no idea how I felt about anything. I didn't know if I loved him or if he was what I wanted. I just knew that, finally, here was someone saying he loved me. I'd done very little dating, knew almost nothing about men. I'd been too busy taking care of things at home. I was so empty inside, and here was this person offering me what seemed like so much, and he said he loved me. I'd been doing all of the loving for so long, and now it seemed as if it was my turn to be on the receiving end, and just in time. I knew I was almost totally drained, that I had nothing left to give. Well, we were married quickly, without his parents' knowledge. It sounds so crazy now, but at the time it all seemed to show how much he loved me. That he was willing to defy his parents to be with me. I thought then that he was rebelling by marrying me, just Enough of a rebellion to make his parents angry, but not enough so they'd throw him out. I see it differently now. After all, he had secrets to keep about his sexual identity and behavior, and having a wife made him look more normal than not having one. I guess that was what he meant when he said he needed me. And of course, I was a perfect choice because